When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
Let's Talk, presented by Anna Glavinsky.
Pure Gold is the name of the book written by Eamon Carr, who started out as a lyricist and drummer and then became a journalist. And he started out his journalistic career by interviewing people. So this is really fun because I'm going to be interviewing Eamon about interviews. And I actually feel a little bit like I'm perhaps in the spotlight. Good morning, Eamon. How are you doing?
Good morning, Anna. How are you? It's great. Brilliant.
Yeah, really good. Thanks. Really good. I don't really know where to start with you. You've got such an interesting career behind you. Obviously, we're going to be going a lot into the book, but we'd like to get to know you a little bit better. Where did you first start out? Who were you before you became the journalist?
Okay, right. Well, in the 1960s, I left a small town in Ireland and I went across to Liverpool. Because obviously, you know, I was infatuated by all that Merseybeat. And there I met Roger McGough, Adrian Henry, and members of the Liverpool scene, that whole incredibly expressive poetry scene. And I, with their encouragement, essentially, I embarked on a career, so to speak, of writing. And writing poetry initially, and then came back to Ireland, set up a small press, organising poetry readings, so on. And then developed a musical wing and then formed a band called Horslips, which was a sort of loosely just a bunch of mates getting together in the evening, playing folk music, and then added electricity and amped it up and we found an audience. And then we found a career. So it was a complete accident. And... around 1980, we decided after making, I don't know, 13 or 14 albums that we and touring American Storm, that we'd, we call it a day. And at that point, I wound up writing reviews and book reviews and album reviews and music stuff and theatre and so on. And then an editor called me in and said, listen, we'd like to do a weekly, famous person interview, and we want you to do it. And that was all very fine and grand, but, you know, although I'd done loads of interviews as, you know, a musician, the idea that I would actually have to ask other people questions about their personal life, I just didn't have it in me, you know. I wanted to be a journalist, but suddenly this was the real deal. And frankly, I actually said no initially, and he said, no, come on, look, you can just go and do it. Okay.
You're turning down an opportunity that people be biting their arms off.
I know. You see, I wanted the easy way out. I just wanted to write silly features about, you know, living in flatland and, and sort of pet care and what gardening. But as it turns out, I said, okay, yeah, I'll do this. I thought I better show willing, otherwise, you know, I might lose the gig. So he said, make out a list of people and you'll need to get a couple in the bag because it's going to be very difficult to get, you know, somebody well-known and you know, internationally well-known every week. And we're talking about an Irish evening newspaper. It's we're not talking about the Evening Standard, you know, whatever. So I made out a list. On top of that list, just, you know, that afternoon, was the manager of the Irish football team, it was Jack Charlton. And this was just before Italia 90, was it 1989? And they hadn't qualified, Ireland hadn't qualified at that point and had never qualified for a World Cup tournament, finals. And so I put Jack on the top of the list. And so I said, I'll ring. So I got his number and I phoned him. And of course, I hadn't given this much thought. And so Jack answered the phone. I mean, imagine being able to do that, you know, get a phone number and ring somebody at their home. And I said, oh, Mr. Charlton, Eamon Carr here in Dublin and blah, blah. I'd like maybe to, you know, do an interview with you when you're next in town. And Jack started swearing. And it was just, it was quite endearing. But on the other level, on the other hand, I was the person trying to sort of launch my career as an interviewer. And he said, oh, bloody hell, have you not got enough effing interviews? I'll be effing over. Blah, blah. I went, oh my God, what am I going to, how do I get out of this? So I said, oh, Jack, I said, no. It's not about your footballers. And I knew we'd be protective about the team and the squad and all that. So I said, it's not about their injuries or, you know, tactics or any of that stuff. I was winging it, you know. I said, I'd like to talk to you about the players that you admired when you were growing up. you know, Tom Finney and, you know, Billy Wright and Stanley Matthews. And these names just tumbled into my head and from my childhood. And he said, oh, yeah, right, okay. See you in the hotel on Sunday. And put the phone down. And then I did. I went, hotel? What? Anyway, so I checked it out and he was coming in on the Sunday for a pre-season or whatever it was, a friendly match on the Wednesday. And so I went along to his hotel and he said, I'm going in and have dinner. He says, come and have dinner with me. I said, no. I wouldn't interview a man when he's having his dinner. I was thinking of myself here. I wasn't thinking of him. I was thinking, how am I going to coax and, you know, question that when he's chewing on a potato or, you know. And so he said, oh, you'll, and he starts swearing again. No, oh, you'll effing come in. You'll have your effing dinner with me. We'll sit down with him. So I went in and we started chatting. And we started talking about, he mentioned one of his players and I mentioned something about the player. I remember seeing him in his first match and I said something about him and then Jack said, no, it was, I said, it was against Tunisia. He said, no, it wasn't. It was against Yugoslavia. That's how long ago it was. It was a country called Yugoslavia. And I said, no, it was Tunisia. It was bloody Yugoslavia. And I suddenly realised, but we hadn't started interviewing per se. And I was already having an argument with Jack Charlton, which anybody knows Jack Charlton. You don't come out well if you have an argument. So he looked at his assistant manager and he said, who was it? And he said, the lad's right, boss. And Jack looked at me and he said, have you got a tape recorder? I said, it's in my bag. Put it up on that bloody table. And so I put up my tape recorder and it was a cassette, a Pro Walkman with a C90 cassette. I mean, we're talking retro stuff now. C90 cassette, 90 minutes. And he started chatting. I could have asked him anything. And in fact, I more or less did. And I ran out of tape. 90 minutes later, he's still going. He wanted to talk all night. He was on a roll. And I was on a roll. And it was the most incredible conversation. And I had a whale of a time. I thought, I went, wow, this is great. You know, I mean, of course, the following week, you know, I met somebody who was taciturn and didn't want to, you know, reveal anything. And so, and then I realized, oh my God, you know, it's, yeah, this is the real thing. It's when you get an interviewer who, or an interviewee rather, who, not that they're shy, it's just that they want to stick to the message or be on message and sell the product or And that product can be anything. You know, it can be a political seat, it can be a book, a novel, theatre, or just themselves, their ego, you know. But once you start asking broader questions that the readers might find interesting, they stonewall, you know, and then some of them are quite dismissive as well, you know. So I mean, I met all sorts, you know. Some could be rude, and that it wasn't even the ones who were rude. It was the ones who were dismissive. They were the ones, you know, just frankly, just, you know, you weren't on their radar. You know, this was just something that they had to do, just, you know, just get through their day, you know, and were sort of quite dismissive. But by and large, and the weird thing is, I thought this, I might get away with this for maybe a month or 6 weeks or, you know, whatever, a couple of months. It ran for years. And I was very lucky in that it was at a period when, you know, people were available and you could access people. And I you know, it's, obviously all of that has changed. But what I did, you see, I kept the tapes. I threw the tapes in a box because I was paranoid. I was afraid in case their agents would ring up and say, oh, my client didn't say that, or, you know, whatever. And I could say, oh, no, have it on tape. And anyway, the box of tapes wound up in the back of the attic. And from time to time, I've been known to bore people at dinner parties or in the pub with anecdotes about, oh, the day I interviewed Gaza, or, you know, nonsense, you know. And then Sheena Quinn, who's a commissioning editor at Merriam Press in Dublin, she said one day, have you ever thought of maybe writing about some of this? And I said, yeah, I have, you know. Well, she said, why don't you get on with it then? I said, oh, okay. So I dug out the tapes and started going through them, transcribing. And I realized then that, in fact, if I had a tape and there was maybe an hour's conversation, only a portion of that would have appeared in print originally. So there's a lot of stuff on. So a lot of it was, I felt it was interesting. So I whittled, I went through, loads and loads of tapes. And I came away with something like 15 interviewees that I thought had something interesting to say, or had a good personality, or were passionate about something. And I thought, yeah. And the weird thing is, there's a sort of a few psychic threads that sort of link them as well, which was quite curious. There's a bit of a broad church. You know, one minute it's Eartha Kitt, and then it's Malcolm McLaren. But I stayed away from music, although I there could be a separate book in terms of famous musicians. But I didn't want to get into the music thing too much, because I found people like Tony Warren, the man who created Coronation Street in the 60s, I found him fascinating. Willie Russell, a playwright. John Mortimer, great novelist who wrote, you know, the Rumpole of the Bailey, that series. I mean, he was wonderful, fascinating character, and hilarious. And he found humour in everything. And Josephine Hart, who wrote Damage and Sin, a couple of really great novels. And her backstory is, I think her backstory is phenomenal. She's an Irish woman, wound up in London, after a family tragedy in Ireland, and married Maurice Sacchi, and had been very successful in magazine publishing, and then sort of decided that she'd follow her passion and started producing plays in theatre in the West End, and award-winning plays and award-winning productions. And then wrote a couple of novels. Well, wrote a few novels. I started running poetry evenings in the British Museum with the likes of, you know, Jeremy Irons and Liam Neeson and people reading poetry. So she was fascinating. And of course, Brenda Fricker, who is the Irish actress who won an Oscar for My Left Foot, And a curious thing there, I mean, she wins the Oscar, first Irish person to win an Oscar since the 40s, I think it was, and first Irish woman certainly to win an Oscar. And she hadn't been expecting it. And she, in my left, was she was up opposite Daniel Day-Lewis, and in the film. And so anyway, she made a great speech from the heart when she won her award. And so I, you know, everybody, you know, features editor, people said, oh, wouldn't it be marvelous if you could have speak to Brenda, you know, and, yeah, but I'm sure she's in LA partying. So I rang her father's house, and I just to see, you know, had he any idea when she might be arriving back in Ireland? And he said, oh, she's upstairs asleep. I said, really? I thought she was still in LA. No, he said she came back yesterday. But I'll tell her to ring you when she wakes up. I said, oh, no, it's cool. No, I will. So Brenda Fricker rang me. And I said, right. And she said, you fancy going for a pint? I said, does the Pope wear a big hat? I'm there. And off I go. And had a great afternoon just sitting in the corner of a pub with Brenda Fricker. And she was sort of slightly jet-lagged and she was just acclimatizing. And she'd come back the previous day. Her favorite restaurant in Dublin, the Trocadero, had thrown a party for her that night. And she was sleeping it off during the day. And then she hooks up with me and she just chatted away. Now she was kind of, it was an interview and the tape recorder ran. And so that doesn't happen anymore, you know. I mean, I tried to get someone else once who'd won an Oscar for Ireland. And I was told, no, this person is sort of all interviewed out. And I'm thinking, oh, yeah. But I mean, whereas Brenda was tremendous, you know, just, and what amazing actress. I mean, just, you know, really powerful, you know. So a lot of interesting characters.
Yeah, it sounds like you had an absolutely fascinating time. The book's going to be like jammed, squeezed with stories. I've got two questions I'd like to quickly ask you that aren't specifically about the book themselves, but I'd love to have your thoughts because of your life experience. The first one is, you've obviously spoken to a lot of famous people. In your experience, is there anything that they all have in common? Is there something that makes famous people particularly famous? Or when you actually meet them, are they just like real normal humans, like every single one of the rest of us? What's your experience of mixing with stars?
Yeah, I quite frankly, I think by and large, the really good ones are quite normal people and have a great appreciation of that and of life and of their, for want of a better word, their good fortune. However, I have to also add that any of these people that I've met that have really achieved something extraordinary in their career, their profession, have been totally committed. I mean, it's beyond 100%. They are so passionate about it. They're so devoted to it. And frankly, they would do, you know, they would commit to what their vision. Much more than the likes of me, you know. I mean, they were, you know, they obviously they had a talent as well. They have some sort of a God-given talent, but they worked at it. They worked to develop it, and their work practices were, you know, in some cases extraordinary. So it's really, you know, there was always an expression: you only get out of it what you put into it. And these people, you know, they had to start from a good base, obviously, with a certain a modicum of talent, but then really work to develop it. So I think hard work and by and large, now I've met some people who frankly had maybe big ideas about themselves and were a bit tedious about it and boring about it. And they also achieved something, but they weren't as personable, you know.
Yeah.
But by and large, it's really hard work. That's the thing. You know, it's like soccer players and football players, they practice to score those goals, you know.
They put in the graft. and you can't take that away from them at the end
Pangra.
Of it.
No,
my other question for you, Eamon, just before we have to go, is are you interested in interviews these days? Do you listen to any podcasts? Do you watch any interviews on TV? Or do you think that the style of it has changed so much since when you first started out? Is, you know, you're not really interested anymore?
No, I'm still intrigued, and I still, you know, podcasts maybe not so much, I'll be honest. But I'll still pick up. Obviously, I still pick up magazines, and yeah, if you know, I'll read a piece, or I'm intrigued by an individual or whoever it might be, and then I'll dive in. So, very much, I still absorb. An awful lot. I mean, I think essentially we have to, don't we? And we're part of the industry of human happiness. So I think, you know, it's all in the mix. And you know, I just think it's, you know, I've developed a fascination, which I felt I didn't have initially, in other people's lives.
Yeah.
And now I'm happy to pick up a magazine and read everything about a person. So no, I do. I read more than, frankly, listen. I think if it's, you know, those TV interviews tend not to be as, they're always a tiny bit studied, you know, mm-hmm. television, that is. And, but I actually, I love radio because I did some radio, and a quick one. I did a radio first very early on, Tanita Tickerham. I know that she's got a new record out, right? But I interviewed her on national radio in Ireland. I think it might have been her first radio interview. She was nervous. And it was sprung on me, you know, like the producer came in and said, oh, we've got Tanita Tickerham. And I said, oh, yeah, great. That new record's great. So Tanita Tickerham came in, sat down opposite me, and she was a young woman and she was nervous. And I said, there you go. Right. Cool. And the mic, you know, when the mic was off, I said, well, we'll just have a chat. And she said, yeah. And she was cool. So I asked her about her maybe favourite authors or something. I was talking about Virginia Woolf. And so it was a nice conversation. But her agent stood behind her in the room. So I'm looking at her, but I can't ignore the fact that her agent is right behind her head. She didn't fully appreciate this. She didn't realise it. And if I asked a question or went down a line of inquiry that he didn't like, he started waving. He was waving me off, and it was really distracting.
Oh,
and
gosh.
Of course, you know what that's like. Imagine somebody trying to tell you how to do your job. And so as it happened, I remember asking her, was she an army brat? And the guy nearly had a seizure. He was freaking out. And in fact, she had been born in Germany. Her dad had been in the army. But of course, that might have been seen as a bit uncool, perhaps, you know, in music circles. But she was wonderful, and she was great, and we had a lovely conversation. But the agent was standing behind her, and he was waving.
Oh,
he was
God, that sounds horrendous. Anyway. Yeah. But fantastic. Anyway, we've been speaking to Eamon Carr. His book is called Pure Gold, and it wraps up a load of interviews and extra information about people that he's interviewed in the past. Such a personable person. I can see why. I reckon he's really able to get down and deep with the people that he's spoken to. I think more because of personality than the timing that when you did it, but I'm sure that did play a little part in it as well. Eamon, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Anna, thank you.
Take care. Thank you. Goodbye. So the book is called Pure Gold. You can find it on Amazon or on the Talk Radio Europe bookshop.
When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom. All lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. Shopify.com/audioboom.